We'll take up our second session on the home. Marriages are made in heaven and lived out on earth. And that's where the problem comes. Or where the frustration, the adjustments, God puts them together and He's willing to make them work if we let Him help us. But the difficulty is that we get started on some wrong patterns in our relationship, and they become vicious cycles. It often starts, it's kind of like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? And all of a sudden we just wake up and we've got a conflict in our relationship. And I think it's because she did this, but she says, I did that because you said this, and then I said this because you did that. It just becomes a vicious cycle. And all of a sudden, we're operating in the flesh. We're selfish. We're looking after our own interests. And that's where the problem gets started. But the beautiful thing is that God is a God of reconciliation. As I said this morning, He can just take some of the He can take some of the most miserable situations that are just disaster. And when we give all the pieces to Him, He can put it together in a beautiful way. And there may be some of the scars there. There's some of the repercussions of what has happened in our relationship. But God can get glory and great glory when everything is put in His hands. I think of some of the closest times that Jerry and I have had spiritually and just in our total relationship with each other have been after a crisis of some kind. But where we were willing to humble ourselves and say those six hardest words that there is in the English language, I was wrong, please forgive me. And we get down on our knees together and pray and ask God to forgive each of us, asking God for forgiveness and asking Him to put the problem, to straighten the problem out. Have you ever had a situation that just became so confused that you just thought, how in the world can this ever get straightened out without us being penalized? Well, God can do that. God just loves to put things together again. I remember one day, we lived in Washington, D.C., and my little boy, who is now 15, was about 2, and he was playing very carelessly with one of his toys. And I warned him. I said, son, if you continue to play careless with your toy like that, you're going to break it. And sure enough, in just a little while, he came running in with tears streaming down his cheeks, brokenhearted, and he had broken his toy. And my first response was to say, okay, pal, you deserve it. You just deserve to have a broken toy. I warned you. But as he poured out his little tail to me, Daddy, please fix it. Daddy, please fix it. I looked down into his little face, and there was just a pathetic look there. And I thought, you know, now justice would say, okay, I warned you, so just live with it broken for a while. But I'd only given him one warning, and I looked down into his face, and there was this pathetic look, and I thought, you know, if he tried for 5 years, he couldn't put that toy back together, but I can. So I thought, well, I'll deal with him in mercy instead of justice. And so I said to him, okay, pal, let me have it, and I'll fix it for you. So he said, thank you, Daddy, and he rubbed the tears out of his eyes, and he went off. And I glued it together and put a vise on it, and after a while it was dried, and I called him in and gave him his toy all put together again. And boy, he was so happy. And he went off playing, and I forgot about it. And the next day I was supposed to go speak at Fourth Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. to a missionary conference. I'd been asked to come over and speak. And just before I left the house, Jerry and I got into a disagreement. I don't even remember what the issue was, but all I know was that I left her in tears. In fact, one day, I'd backed her into a corner. I had a way of talking, and she didn't have any answer. And she said to me, she said, Jim White, you should have been a lawyer. She says, you backed me into a corner, and I don't know what the answer is, but I know you're wrong. But this was one of those times when just with words And conniving around, I had backed her into a corner, and she was devastated. I left her in tears, and here I was driving down the freeway to go speak to a Christian meeting. And I just felt low. I was feeling ashamed of myself, and I thought, you know, I don't have any business going speaking to somebody or anybody or any meeting this morning having treated my wife that way, just kind of steamrolling my way through an argument and leaving her without an answer and leaving her without a relationship with me. And I just, the devil was just screaming in my ear, God can't do anything. You don't have anything to say. You can't get out of it, though. You've got to go. They're counting on you. And as I was driving along, I kind of looked up through the tinted part of my mirror into heaven, and I all of a sudden Rodney's face popped into my mind with tears streaming down his cheeks with his little broken toy. And I just all of a sudden put myself in Rodney's shoes, and I was standing before God with this broken relationship with my wife. And I said, Dear God, would you fix it? I don't know how. I mean, what do I do at this point? I've got to go speak, and I've got this broken relationship. So when I got to the church, I went to a phone, and I called her, and I asked her forgiveness, and asked her if she would pray and ask God to forgive me and to bless me in what I had to do. I said, Honey, I wish I didn't have to speak. I wish I could just get out of this, but... And so, you know, I went and spoke that morning to that meeting, and I can never remember having come away from a meeting where people commented more on what God had said to their hearts. And you know, it occurred to me, you know, that's grace. God loves to bless us when we're weak and when we are broken and know that we are wrong and will be willing to take the responsibility for it. And God is the adhesive. He is the cementer of our sentiments. He is the great adhesive in a marriage relationship, and He loves to put the pieces together. But Jerry and I have found that often after reconciliation, we feel so much closer with each other. Then someone says, Well, man, won't you have a big fight then every day? Just verbal battle, and then, man, make up and have a good time. Well, that's like Paul said, Shall we sin that grace may abound? He said, God forbid. I look back, and I thank God for what He's done through each of the conflicts we've experienced in the 16 years of our marriage, but I wouldn't want to repeat any of them. I like the results, but I don't like the process. No, I don't think we should approve the process. Someone once said that marriage is for procreation, it's for happiness and joy, but it's also for training. And God puts two people together in the most intimate of relationships. Before your marriage, you have two bank accounts, two bodies, two bedrooms. You get married, you have one bedroom, one body, one bank account. If you didn't like your roommate in college, you can move out. But this one is for keeps. And it forces you. It's a situation you can't run from. If there's any scum of self and sin in our lives, marriage will bring it to the surface. But then what do we do with it? Do we get into patterns of hiding it or justifying ourselves? Will we face up to it and say, God, I have sinned? See, David, when you look at David, he, in a sense, he committed a far more hideous sin than Saul did. Saul just didn't obey God, didn't kill all the sheep, didn't kill the king Agag. David committed adultery, and he committed murder. And yet when Nathan came and said, Thou art the man, David said, I have sinned. And I believe that's what makes us men and women after God's own heart, is when in our relationship something comes up and our mate or our children say, Thou art the man. You've been selfish. You're self-centered. Instead of defending ourselves and squirming around and all of a sudden steamrolling to throw dust in the air to confuse the issue and make the other person look like the bad guy, to just say, Sweetheart, I've sinned. I'm wrong. Please forgive me. And so yesterday, we talked about that each human being, a husband and a wife, have needs. They're God-given. They're built in. And oftentimes we go about trying to meet our own needs, and that's where we get in trouble. When I communicate to my mate, but I have a right for acceptance, and you show me acceptance. You see, that's when, if you save your life, you lose it. Or I have a right to be thanked. So I'm demanding that you give me gratitude. I'm demanding that you affirm me. I'm demanding that you be considerate of me. Then when you demand, what did Jesus say? It's a principle. If you save your life, you'll lose it. Now, the point of our workshop these last two mornings is this. We do have legitimate needs, but we cannot demand that our mates meet them. We have to surrender those needs to God and let God meet them through our mates or in some other way. It may be that this side of heaven our mates never will, even if we have 100 workshops, be perfect in meeting those needs in our lives. And it's only as we look to God that we will not be disappointed. It's our expectations from a sinful, weak human being that gets us in trouble. Because our expectations always tend to be a very, very high standard. You know, when I just stop and think about it, it is absolutely impossible for Jerry to meet all my expectations. She'd have to be God. So therefore, if my expectations are God-sized, then I better look to God to meet them. But as I look back on our marriage and the conflicts we have had, it's always been when I demanded that she meet my needs. And that's where we get in trouble. But then, on the other hand, I say, okay, I won't demand that she meets my needs. Whether she ever does or not, I'll look to God to meet my needs. But boy, then, I want to make sure that with the right attitude, the right spirit, I knock myself out to meet her needs. Then if you get a couple, both of you doing that, there's a lot of room for human failure in there, and you're not disappointed because you weren't expecting it anyway. So yesterday we talked about the need for acceptance, the need to feel that my mate really takes me as a gift from God, and that I accept her the way she is, with her strengths, but also with her weaknesses, her human frailties. And we talked about gratitude, how gratitude is a need in a human heart, and how God can use us to meet that need in our mate's life by saying thank you, and to say it quite often. We talked about affirmation, which is disciplining in ourselves to quit focusing on our mate's weaknesses and to focus on their strengths, and to comment on them and build them up. And then they will turn and take care of the weaknesses. Now that does not mean that we cannot discuss each other's weaknesses. We do need to do that, provided it's the right time and in the right way with the right spirit. And we talked about consideration, how it was just Jesus washing the disciples' feet. Little things like, if I'm going to have to be late for supper, to give my wife a ring and let her know as soon in advance as we can. You know, here the wife is all day long. She's spent her time pouring over a hot stove and to create a beautiful supper and puts it on the table, and I don't show up on time. Well, see, that's just being inconsiderate. So those were the four needs that we talked about yesterday that each of us have the opportunity to meet in our mates' lives. Now, before we go on to four more this morning, let me just stop and ask you, since yesterday, 24 hours ago, what questions have come to your mind that you'd like to just speak from the floor on those four subjects that we talked about yesterday? Yes, I think so. And see, the first step in ever making progress on anything is to identify what I'm doing wrong and what I must do right. If you get those clear, then they'll kind of go in and out of focus, but you can always come back to it and tune up. See, I'll be very honest. I have to stop and think, but I'm sure even within the last week or two or day or two,
that Jerry may have done something that I kind of thought, hey, nuts on that. You know, I'd have to stop and think a minute, but I'm sure I probably have. So even if I am working toward acceptance, the important thing is maybe in the early years of marriage, maybe I go sometimes for weeks before I finally say, God, my job is to love her, not change her. Your job will be to change her in whatever way, and her to say that concerning me. But then to cause those times of agitating and demanding and trying to change our mates to have them further and further apart. And I've found that once I can identify what I'm doing wrong and clearly see it, and then see what I should be doing and clearly see that, then the Holy Spirit, the next time I do it, can say, oop, there it is. Oh, yeah. God, forgive me. And get back on the path. I can guarantee you that no matter how much you meditate on this week, you will not show your mate complete acceptance for the rest of your life after this conference. But if we can catch the vision that we ought to, like Paul said in Romans 15:7, accept one another just as God, for Christ's sake, in Jesus Christ, accepted us to the glory of God. So, what we want to do is be encouraged by progress, not perfection. Because we won't be perfect till we get to heaven. Yeah, sweetheart? That's a good point. Why don't you comment on that? Yeah, that's it. Yes, that's a very good distinction. Okay, good. Yes, honey, do you want to stand up and say it? She said that acceptance is not approval. In other words, you don't have to approve of what your mate's doing. You can still show acceptance. And some people think that acceptance just means that everything your mate does, you just approve of it and become a yes girl, a doormat, and so forth. Trade your brains for a broom. You know, you don't do that. That's not acceptance. It's just saying yes, dear, yes, dear. But it's an attitude of... See, honestly, I tell you, we talk about the word hate and hostility. And we see wars. We see tribalism over in Africa. Wars and people cutting each other up. But honestly, there is just as much hostility sometime between a man and his wife as there ever was in a war. I mean, hate really breeds in a marriage relationship. And what we're talking about is how to get that sense in our relationship that, boy, my mate, even with weaknesses, and usually the reason we get upset with our mate is because something he or she does really threatens me or threatens my ego. And then, boy, I want to get in there and devastate that thing. It makes me feel small. And if we don't handle it in the right way and do some confession and have reconciliation and getting on our knees to pray together, we become enemies. We're not friends. And I personally believe that the goal that God would have for each of us as husband and wife is to eventually, someday, through the process of working on it, to be each other's best friend that you have in the world. And, but you see, many times in marriage, that's not true. The man, he has his buddy that he plays golf with or tennis or something, and boy, I mean, they're the best of pals. And the husband and wife are not friends. But I believe, personally, that God wants Jerry to be the best friend I have in the world. And vice versa. Yes?
I have difficulties with putting that into practice. I agree with the theory that it's hard for me if Jim does something that I don't approve of to really communicate acceptance of him as a person. Can you give me an example of how you might do it? Is it in what you say? Is it in how you communicate your disapproval? Or not saying that you disapprove?
All right. You see, the very emotion that causes me to get upset
And I can identify with that. Anytime I get upset over something, the tendency is to immediately begin to dig in there and try to take it apart and straighten it out and tell him off and, you know, and get all this. But what I'm learning is the very moment I feel this negative emotion, to stop and ask myself, now this bothers me, but why does it bother me so much? It may be wrong, but why does it bother me so much? And I think here we're coming to the principle that Jesus talked about in Matthew 7 when he said, if you see a splinter in your brother's eye, go get the beam out of your own eye, and then you shall see clearly how to help your husband or wife get the splinter out of her eye. Boy, you know, I don't want some guy operating on me someday on the operating table that's got something wrong with his eyesight. If he's wearing new glasses the first day, he operates on me. Man, wait a week. I don't want him, or take, you know, get him off so you can see. Well, see, this is what happens. If I tear into Jerry over something and lash her with words, she may have been wrong, but I'm wrong too. There's sin in my heart. And there's two ways to open up a person. You can open them with a sword or you can open them with a scalpel. One they live, the other they die. And Jesus is just saying, if you're going to open somebody up, open them with a scalpel. But you can only do that after you've scrubbed up, so you're germ-free. See, you don't want anyone operating on you with dirty hands after they've just come from milking the cows in the cow lot. I mean, what I'm saying here, the world says, count to ten. Well, you know, that's worldly psychology, but they do have a good point. In other words, give it some time before you talk. And first of all, search our own hearts to say, now, God, she may have been wrong in what she did, but why does this bother me so much? Well, it steps on my pride. It makes me look like I'm not the leader I ought to be in the home. And God, this is pride on my part. And so I get my own heart right, and then I have a clear vision to be able to see exactly what she's doing wrong and how she can best solve the problem. I can remember, just like a mountain peak, the very first time I ever tried that and it worked. I can remember I was about to leave on a trip the next day, and I was already lying there in bed, and Jerry came over and sat down on the bed, and she just leaned over and kissed me on the cheek. She had done something a day or two before that really concerned me, but I just tie right into it. I want to leave no loose ends. Just get straightened out, and then I can go on to something else. But this time I just waited. And for a couple of days I prayed, searched my own heart, got my own heart right, and tried to think, now what is the real problem here, and what does she need? Prayed about it. God gave me the principles that I thought were the real issue. And then maybe just two or three practical steps of what she could do about it if she wanted any advice from me. So she leaned over and kissed me, and I said, honey, I really appreciate your affection. It's very meaningful to me, but I said, could I just talk to you for a few minutes about something that happened the other day? And she winced, you know, understandably, because in the past, if I'm going to talk about anything that just happened, why, you know, I'd nail her to the wall. She looked at me with her eyes kind of wide and says, yeah, but what's the matter? I said, well, it's okay, just relax. It's no big thing, but I thought we might discuss it first, you know, get it out of the way. So I began to unravel this thing, and she says, do you mind if I go around and lay down? I said, no, fine. So she went around, she laid down, and I kind of got up on my elbow, and we just, boy, had a terrific time for the next 30 minutes discussing the problem and got it out of ourselves. I heard, well, we could look at it. And she was very relaxed, and she was looking objectively at it, and I was looking at it, and she looked over at me with tears streaming down her cheeks, just with a look of peace on her face, and she said, Jim, she says, I don't want to do that. I mean, I don't want to be that way. She said, do you mind if I get up and get a piece of paper and write down what you've just said? I think that's the way I ought to do about that. Well, you see, in the past, she had never done that because I would put her on the defensive by the steamrolling way I'd come in on something. And this time she not only was taking it, but wanted to write it down. And she said, would you pray with me about it? So she wrote it down, and we got down on our knees and just poured out our hearts to the Lord. And I said to God, I said, Lord, why have I been so stupid? I mean, Ecclesiastes 8:5 says, a wise man's heart discerns both timing and procedure. There's a right time and a right way to do everything. And see, I can only help somebody else if my own heart is clean and I'm sure that what I'm saying to them, I'm saying in the love of Jesus Christ. So I think the answer to that is to not speak when you first react, but first go and ask God to fill your heart with wisdom and love. And then when you bring it to their attention, they sense that though you're rejecting their action, you're not rejecting them. See, it's the same idea with children. They tell us, don't ever discipline a child in anger when you're out of control. And then send them to their room alone, because what you're doing is you're communicating, I'm rejecting you, you're bad. And the objective of discipline with children is to discipline them in such a way as to say to them, though I despise and hate what you did, I love you. So, this child psychologist told us several years ago, make sure you're calm, you've got your own heart under control emotionally. You spell out to the child why you're doing it. You spank them, pull them up on your lap, and just let them feel the warmth of your body close by while they're crying over the pain of the spanking. And this child psychologist says to us, this way the child says, ah, it was my behavior he's rejecting, but not me. He loves me. Well, see, when we are settling a dispute with our mate, that's the objective, is to say, though I disagree with what you did, I love you. Yes. Yes. I hadn't thought of that, but that is a good principle to see. When Paul, like we said yesterday, when he had to say something hard to the Corinthian church, he called to mind their strengths first. All right, any other question on any of the four yesterday? Yes.
You said that in the past, change our mind. How do you practically deal with the frustration of giving God that job?
Yeah. Well, I one time told someone that I do not believe that God will ever give me the grace to not do something wrong until I come to the place that every time I do something wrong, I take the responsibility for it. In other words, I go through the red light and I say, well, God, why didn't you give me a caution light? He says, well, will you say you were wrong through going through the red light? Well, but I didn't have a caution light. God says, did you go through the red light? Yes, God, I did. Okay, now every time you catch yourself going through the red light, throw up your hands and say, I was wrong. Then when you get in the habit of that, I'll start turning the caution light on. I'll let you see the caution light. And every time I catch myself jumping in and taking over God's job of trying to change my mate, if I'll say, that is not my business, I stepped into the wrong role and I judge myself for it, then all of a sudden, the day I think comes when all of a sudden I'm about to say something and that little blinking yellow light comes on. I think, oh yeah, that's right. I better wait a while. Now sometimes God will change our mates by something we say, but it's got to be with love and in a constructive way. And I don't know about you, but when I'm emotionally upset, it is almost impossible to think logically. Isn't it? Man, you say things that later you think, why in the world did I say that? And boy, watch the generalizations come out. You never do this. You always do. Watch those two words, never and always. Don't they come out in a conflict? And the truth of the matter is that our mates don't always do anything. And they never, never do anything. Those are two extremes that just never are, but boy, do we use them. You always say such and such. You always do and such. You never do such and such. See, well, if we need to step in and do some, if God wants to use me to give some information to my mate, that'll help be the construction material to make an interchange. But you remember Paul said, I have planted, Apollos watered, but God gives the increase. It's only God who can change people permanently. And I have rarely ever in a marriage seen someone change where the other mate was saying, change, change, change. And it is, God has said that change must be in an atmosphere of love. Now, occasionally you'll find somebody who has the grace from God to go to God and say, well, God, my husband is just doing this to me and I don't have the love atmosphere with which to change for his sake, but I am going to change for your sake. And your love is going to be enough for me. Now, sometimes God does that in a mate's life. And one mate changes and the other one just goes on the rest of his life just doing this. Well, one mate has a great advantage and the other is sadly, sadly lacking. But most of the time, in most marriages, change just doesn't take place if there's not an attitude of an atmosphere of acceptance. Where I'm communicating, though you have this weakness and that, and I don't approve of them, boy, honey, I really love you, though. And this, we're talking about God's love, agape love, and by, that love is a miracle anyway. See, it's only a miracle from God that I can love anybody just for themselves. All right, well, let's go on here this morning on another need. And boy, this one, I believe, is probably one of the most neglected needs in marriages, because the type of home you came from, the type of relationship you had with your mother and father determined the capacity for this need in your life. And most of the time, one mate has a different type of manifestation of that need than the other mate, and getting those two functioning like a well-oiled, well-timed machine is difficult. But over 50% of the problems that come to marriage counselors are due to a silent husband. And the need is for communication. He never talks to me. You've seen the cartoons of the husband and wife sitting at the table. And the first one shows her sitting over there, you know, grumbling because he's got the newspaper up in front of his breakfast. The second cartoon, the second picture, shows her reaching over and pulling the newspaper down. And the surprised look on her face when she sees him all with his beard and his mussed-up hair, and the third one shows her pushing the newspaper back up. But there's more humor. In that humor, there's a tremendous principle involved in that she was desperately left on an emotional island wanting to know, would you listen to me? Can I talk to you? And the problem with communication is that if we don't solve that problem, if my wife is not getting her communication needs met, or I'm not getting mine met, this spills over into our sexual relationship. It'll spill over into our relationship to our children. It'll spill over into our jobs. And communication is very, very foundational. And by communication, I mean that verbal and nonverbal means by which two or more people express themselves constructively to one another. See, communication is not only verbal, it's nonverbal. See, you can... Boy, I tell you, there have been many a time when my wife has given me a communication in a group without saying a word. In fact, I've learned when I'm speaking, I keep an eye on my wife. And if I see her brow furrow a little bit, I think, whoops, now wait a minute. I may not have made that clear, or I may have overstated it. And usually when the brow furrows, I'll see the pencil go like this, see? And I really often, after a meeting on the way home, I'll say, well, honey, you have any suggestions for the meeting? And she says, well, I got two or three here. She'll pull it out and share them with me. I find that a great help. But see, that communication of that furrowed brow gave me a little, that spoke volumes. And so communication is both verbal and nonverbal. But it has to be where two or more people express themselves constructively to one another. And you see, in order to really have communication, I have to feel that Jerry has not only listened to me, but she's tried to understand and she's taken me seriously. See, one of the worst things a husband can ever say to a wife is, oh, you know, you shouldn't feel that way. You women are too emotional. Well, see, the truth of the matter is she does feel that way. And I didn't realize until we had been married about 13 years, that feelings were valid. The first 13 years of our marriage, I thought the only two things in life that are really important in communication is truth and duty. As long as it's true and it's your duty, then just do it whether you feel like it or not. And that's still true. You don't just do things because you feel like it. But feelings are a very valid part. They are amoral. They're neither right nor wrong. They just are. Now, if those feelings become bad attitudes, then attitudes are right or wrong. But see, what the objective is for in a marriage, for a wife to feel that her husband reaches out and identifies with her feelings. And I can remember one day I came home discouraged. I'd been discouraged a couple of 3 days. Not discouraged, but just kind of heavy. And I went up in the bedroom and shut the door. And I said, honey, let me talk to you a minute. And she came over and I stood against the dresser. And for the next 15 minutes, I just told her some struggles I was going through on my job and in my relationship to certain people. And I told her, I said, I know these are not right. And I just kicked myself all over the place because I think I'm just being a little, you know, overly sensitive and wearing my feelings on my cuff, and I shouldn't feel this way, but this is the way I feel. And she stood there for 15 minutes and just listened to me. And when I was through, she just looked at me very compassionately, and she said, Jim, I can understand why you'd feel the way you do. Man, I'm telling you, I cannot communicate to you the encouragement that that one little statement was. I understand why you'd feel the way you do. Now, she was not justifying bad attitudes. But see, she got in touch with my feelings. And last night at the ball game, my daughter broke into tears when she struck out. She just was sobbing. She was just petrified. And the game was over, and she was kind of saying a few things. And I went up to her, and I was going to say, no, honey, it really doesn't matter that much. And sweetheart, the important thing is to enjoy the game. Don't be so sensitive. See, I was just going to give her a little sermon about good night. Just enjoy the game. And just about the time I was opening my mouth, Jerry was standing by her, and she went. So I shut my mouth, and we went over, and Val got in the car, and we went to the trunk to put the bats and balls in, and Jerry says, honey, I think the important thing is that I can understand why she'd feel that way. And, but you see, I was about to step in and give her a sermon, and Jerry had identified with her feelings. And now is the time not to give a sermon. Well, you see, there's different levels of communication. And most of us men like to deal on a very objective level, because we can evaluate facts and objectivity. But boy, when you get into the realm of feelings, it's quite difficult. And one day, I came upon Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, that says, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. And I like the King James there because it says that he is touched with the feeling of our infirmities. And boy, what really draws a couple together is when husband and wife can each feel that they have been listened to, understood, and taken seriously, and that they can express everything that they have in their hearts. One day, Jerry shared a poem with me that she found in a book, and it meant so much to me that I memorized it. It says, oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person. Neither having to weigh words nor measure thoughts, but pouring them all right out just as they are, chaff and grain together, assured that a faithful hand will take and sift them. Keep what is worth keeping, and with the breath of kindness, blow the rest away. Now, boy, don't you feel safe with a person like that? A person who you just know you can share anything that you think or feel, and you'll still be accepted. You'll feel you will have been listened to, understood, and taken seriously. And he says, oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of having a person like that as your friend. And I believe that God wants us men especially to learn to go down and to talk on these levels with our wives so that that communication is at the deepest level and we feel safe with each other. And I think it's when communication really begins on this level that a lot of the other problems in our marriages dissolve. But it's because somewhere on the way down we get defensive with each other, or we begin to preach those sermons to each other. And every time, I think almost without exception, every time in our marriage when Jerry was feeling something and she tried to come out with it, and then I came in with the sermon, it always became an occasion for repentance. I always had to go back later and say, honey, a sermon was not what you needed at that moment. I didn't really hear you with my heart. So communication is a need. And it's usually because one person comes from a home where the communication was mainly nonverbal. One fellow says to me, well, in our home, my mom and dad never talked. I mean, we just knew what our duties were, and we just got along, but good night, my wife wants to talk and talk and talk and talk. And I mean, you know, it's a privilege, but she abuses the privilege. Or it's like the guy who someone said to him, is it true you haven't spoken to your wife in 15 years? And he says, that's right. The fellow says, well, why not? And he says, well, I didn't want to interrupt her. Well, though we laugh at something like that, and yet what's happening is that dear wife doesn't feel that she's really being listened to, and so there's just the scratching, desperately hoping he'll open up and listen. And part of being a good communicator is being a good listener. Then the other part is being willing to speak the truth in love. And by the way, I really believe that one of the best ways to become a good communicator, and some of us husbands may need to learn, God doesn't want us to come into marriage and just set up home like our mom and dad had it. It's a new thing he's doing. And I didn't marry my mother. I married someone different than my mother. Jerry and my mother are 180 degrees apart. And they're just their whole emotional makeup. And that's not a mistake. God just wanted to shake me out of the rut of feeling things ought to be done in a certain way and start something new. And a lot of us husbands just need to enroll in the school of learning to be good communicators and good listeners and be vulnerable. You know, sometimes we men think it's unmanly to cry. But boy, tears, a few tears in the right time, in the right way, can be a tremendous means of communicating in marriage, men or women, husbands or wives. Let me give you one more in the common needs, and I'll just cover this very quickly, but it's the need for physical affection. And here again, this is tricky because when we talk about physical affection, men often, the first thing they think of, the word that comes to their mind is sex. But to a woman, to a wife, sex is only a very beautiful part, the very climax and end of a total relationship, which involves kind words, touch, caress. One wife said to us in counseling one day, well, if my husband would just one time, just sometimes, hold me just for me, not for sex. She says, every time he touches me, I know that he has sex in mind. Well, you see, the husband there needs to learn that his wife's physical affection needs are total, not just sexual.
And I remember one night we were sitting in church. We'd just been married. This may not sound, you think, well, what were you doing in church? Well, we were sitting there listening to the sermon, and I had a little ache in my shoulder, and so I put my arm around the back of the seat behind Jerry, and I just laid 3 or 4 fingers on her shoulder, just kind of rested my hand on her shoulder. And she leaned over and said, "I was hoping you'd do that." Well, see, I was beginning to learn something. I thought, well, you know, is that meaningful to her? And, you know, if you don't know what your mate's physical affection needs are, instead of demanding that she or he meet them on your level, this is where communication comes in, of really honestly understanding what each other needs. And so that the total physical affection needs are met. On the other hand, I'd like to just say that many a man has lost 3 or 4 cylinders of his emotional compression in his job because his wife is defrauding him in their physical relationship. And Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 7 very specifically that when you get married, you give up the rights to your body. And the truth of the matter is this, that when Jerry and I got married, my body is no longer mine. Anytime she wants it, it is hers. Just like if I had someone working for me and I didn't pay them on payday, I'm defrauding them. They're entitled to that. It's theirs. And so, in the physical relationship, we are to never say no to each other. Unless it is absolutely necessary, and then it's with the attitude of, "I'm not rejecting you, but very quickly I'll meet those needs as soon as I can." And I believe that the reason there's not a lot of spiritual power sometime in our homes and our ministries is because we're defrauding each other. You see, we play little games. And we get into marriage, and it becomes a little competition. The husband says, "Okay, I control the finances." And the wife says, "Okay, I control the sex." And it just becomes legalized prostitution. "You nice to me, I give you some money. You nice to me, I give you sex." And we don't say it with those words, but that is the attitude. And I remember one day I came home with a paycheck, and one of the kids said something about, "Well, that's daddy's money." I said, "Oh, no, it isn't. It's our money. It's the family's." "Well, Mom didn't work for it. The check's made out to you." And I said, "No." I said, "She was home cooking the meals, doing the washing and watering the grass and during the day." And I said, "Man, that freed me to go work all day. But look at what she's done all day. It's our money. It's her salary as well as mine." So our money is common. Our bodies are common. And it belongs to each other. And I think somewhere very quickly in a marriage, each husband and wife needs to come to God and say, "Dear God, I dedicate my body to you and to my mate, that my mate can have of my body anytime he or she wants it, if it's at all humanly possible." But those are very great needs, and I believe that oftentimes the reason there are problems is because our physical affection needs may not be met. Boy, sometimes in counseling, I'll have a wife say, you know, she just devastated in her self-image because for some reason or other, her husband never wants her body. And that husband does not realize, he must before God realize what that does to a woman, to never be desired. And I believe God can put those desires in there if we're serious about it. So physical affection. Yes. Sure, let's stop right there and have a question.
Is it possible in that kind of context
to go to
there's got to be room for consideration?
That's right.
I mean, you can misuse your mate even in that context. Is that right?
That's true.
You can make a demand in the sexual relationship, which, you know, if she's been tired
from
the day's work, it's really inconsiderate.
Yes. Well, see, here we come back to the need for consideration. But you see, Jesus,
talked about give and it shall be given unto you. And if someone compels you to go a mile, go with him too. And most of the things in life that people demand of us, it really, when it comes right down to it, the time and effort expended is really not some big monumental thing. And maybe if some wife has a husband that she feels is abusing that privilege, she might just ask herself, well, is he just collecting past debts? But now on my point, from my point of view, I really believe that my consideration, see, it comes back to the fact of consideration, the need yesterday. I need to consider, well, what kind of day has she had? Is she tired? And so it's a two-way street. But Oswald Chambers says that the essence of the Sermon on the Mount is, don't ever demand your rights, but never refuse to give others theirs. And I think that from my point of view, no matter how tired I am, if Jerry wants and needs my help, I need to be willing to just pitch myself in there for a little while and give her that help. On the other hand, she needs to be considerate of me. I need to be considerate of her. So the two go hand in hand. Being willing to give to any extent, and on the other hand, and sometimes when you're trying to get a marriage tuned up, there may be a time when Edith Schaefer says, at any given time in a marriage, somebody is doing most of the giving. And it's just always that way. But a healthy marriage is when it kind of shifts like water in a pan. Today or this week, because of a low moment with Jerry, I may be doing most of the giving. Then next week, she may be doing most of the giving. But we don't need to keep records. But also not be feeling like, I've given and given and she still wants me to give, you know. I think the whole gospel message is that I give. Then if I am in touch with God, the gospel message is to me is to be considerate that I don't make demands and abuse my privilege. Yes?
I think the gospel says that we
agree together. Right. That's where communication comes in understanding each other's needs. And I can't help but feel that if I'm walking with God and Jerry's walking with God and we're both surrendered to the Holy Spirit, He is beautifully going to fit my resources to her needs and her resources to my needs. And we'll get tuned up in our marriage to where it's working beautifully. Communication is the big part of it. All right, now we have a quarter of an hour left, and what we want to do is cover a unique need that a husband has and a unique need that a wife has. And I've asked Jerry to come up and to take a unique need that she feels that a husband has, that the wife in the marriage relationship does not have. This is a need that the husband has. And God has told us about it in His Word. And so, sweetheart, come up and... I think they're recording it somewhere.
How do you keep from tripping?
I stuff it in my pocket, but you don't have it.
I'll just be careful. A unique need that a husband has from his wife is the need for her to adapt herself to him. And the word adaption is a word that often we hear the word submission. And submission is a very legitimate word, but it's also been a word that I feel has been greatly misused over the years. There's nothing wrong with the word, but it has come to mean in many of our minds, we just see this thumb coming down, squash, or we as women do, I should say, and we hear the word submission and we're immediately kind of on guard, and yet it is a scriptural word, and I think today we can use a word maybe that communicates a bit more too, if it's more meaningful to us, and that's the word adaptation, and one definition that I have heard of the word adaptation is the ability to adjust to changes. And I really like that definition. When Jim and I were first married, I would say that probably this area was the weakest area in my life. Wouldn't you agree? I was 26 and Jim was 27. And we were both, you know, we'd done things on our own for quite a while. And we each had our little patterns, our little way of doing things. And we suddenly had to mesh our lives together. And there were some rough edges. And they very soon showed up. I had very definite tastes in things. For example, I like my milkshakes super thick, and I wanted my steaks medium rare, and I wanted no deviation. Well, I mean, that's a self-centeredness, but nevertheless, that's the way it was. And that's only one example. But I had very definite ideas on things, and I found it very hard to adapt myself to changes in areas. Ephesians 5:22 in the Phillips says, "You wives must learn to adapt yourselves to your husbands as to the Lord." And I underlined those words, "as to the Lord." For the husband is the head of the wife in the same way that Christ is the head of the church. So here we see the way God has positioned it. There's Christ, there's the husband, there's the wife. Now, it's not like we're on the bottom of the totem pole, but as far as role, this is the way God has planned it. I'm glad it says in this verse, learn. You wives must learn to adapt yourselves to your husbands. And I think it is a learning process. At least it has been for me. I've had to learn over the years, and I'm still learning. I guess I've got enough spunk that I'm not the type that just learns everything overnight. But God wants us to be making progress in this area of our lives. And he says, as to the Lord. So when we're stubborn, I think, in our hearts, and we're not willingly adapting ourselves to our husbands, then it is as though we're not doing it to the Lord. It is the same thing as if I'm rebelling against the Lord when I rebel against my husband. And when I challenge Jim's leadership, then I am challenging God's leadership or Christ's leadership in my life. And that's a rather awesome thought, isn't it? Rather sobering. 2 Corinthians 11:3 says, "The head of every man is Christ, and the head of every woman is her husband." And this again brings out the divine order in this. Well, how do we adapt? How do we as wives adapt to our husband's leadership? We don't adapt by being a doormat. And this is a real fear I had when I got married. I thought, boy, I sure don't want to be a yes girl. And I sure don't want to be a doormat. And so I think I swung the pendulum the other way. I think I was so intent on not being a yes girl that I was a no girl in a lot of ways. And I had to learn to try to balance that thing out over the years. I think it's good to have spunk. You know, we want to be able to tell our husbands how we feel about things, but to do it under control. And I don't think God wants us to be doormats. A doormat, God says that we're to be a helper to our husbands. And a doormat is not a helper, is it? There's no way a doormat can be a helper. I think we do not adapt by assuming that our role is one as an inferior role. It's not a matter of being inferior in any way, because God has created us equal. But equality, we have to remember that equality is not sameness. Not sameness. It's a matter of role. God has given us as wives a certain role that we're to fulfill. And it's just as important. It's just a different role. I read an example once in a book that really struck me. It was in Maribel Morgan's book, The Total Woman. And I like the way she defined this. She said, it's kind of like a monarchy. There's the king and there's the queen. The king makes the final decisions on things, right or wrong. He has that position of making final decisions. The queen has the ability to express herself regally. I like that word, regally. And the king is interested in what the queen thinks. He wants her input. And then he considers it. He weighs it very carefully. But when it comes right down to making the decision, he is the one that is held responsible. The husband is the one that God holds responsible. And then whether the decision is right or wrong, then we as wives do not say, yeah, I knew that was going to be wrong, you know. He should have listened to me. We don't take that tack, but rather we support them in it. And then God will bless us for it. I think our whole spiritual walk with Christ depends on our relationship to our husband in this area of adaptation. And if there is a stubbornness and unwillingness to adapt, I don't think we can ever expect to be growing in our relationship to the Lord. nor can we expect for God to be using us in the lives of other people. There's a block there. Something is hindering God from blessing us and using us. I remember once in Washington, D.C., when Jim and I had just been married a couple of years, I was kind of chafing at my role. I was home with the dirt, diapers, and dishes, and he was running off speaking to groups, and I was thinking, oh, you know, how exciting, and my life is very dull, and I've got all these difficult things to do at home. And one night, it kind of came to a head with me. He was ready to leave to speak to a group, and for some reason, the top just came off. And I was spouting off to him, telling him what I thought and how I didn't appreciate being left home with all the things around the house to do and him getting to go to the glamorous things and the fun things. And so I really told him what I thought. I did not do it with control. I did not do it regally. And I remember he stood there with a stunned look on his face. And I was mad, and I turned around, and I walked into the office, and I slammed the door just kind of like that, just feeling rather proud of myself, you know, had the last word. And I got inside, and all of a sudden, I felt like a trapped animal. And that was the Lord making me feel that way. And he brought to my mind, okay, Jerry, you've got two ways that you can go here. Which way is it going to be? You can get down on your knees, and you can confess this, and then make it right to Jim when he gets home later, or you can continue on this road that you're going. Which is it going to be? And I really felt panicky, because the last thing I wanted to do was to get down on my knees and confess it. I did not want to admit that I was wrong. I wanted to stand up for what I thought were my rights. But I knew what would happen if I took that other road. I knew that God's blessing, God's hand would just be lifted off of my life. I could count on that. And so I got down on my knees and poured my heart out to the Lord. And then, of course, you know, that peace came. God's peace came. And I could hardly wait for Jim to get home then to tell him, you know, what I'd done and what God had taught me in the experience. And that has been kind of a milestone with me, one of the milestones in our relationship. Lord, I'm going to look to you to meet this need. I will not demand it of my husband. A little formula that I think helps on this is that we can make, as wives, can make our wishes known to our husbands in a responsible way, and I think we should. I think we need to communicate. I think the worst thing we can do is kind of clam up and just kind of reach up and pull that shade down like pulling a window shade down, and they're on one side and we're on the other. We need to communicate. We need to tell them how we feel, how things are affecting us, but we need to do it in a responsible way. The second thing is then we need to leave the decision with our husband. It doesn't mean we can't make any decisions. There will be a lot we can make, but there are certain ones that they should be finally responsible for. And we need to be willing to leave that with our husband. And then the third thing, I guess you could say, is kind of a result. When we do this, then I really think it makes our mate feel very tender toward us. And then they want to please us. It's not a manipulation type of thing. We're not doing this in order to manipulate them. But this is just simply the cause and effect. This is the way it works. When I am submissive to my husband, when I adapt myself to him, and I accept his leadership, then he in turn feels tender toward me, and he is super sensitive to ways that he can help meet needs in my life that he may not have been as sensitive to before.
So the husband, husbands have the need, as Paul brought out in Ephesians 5, for wives to adapt themselves. But it's not always a one-way street. Just before Paul told wives, be submissive to your husbands, he says, yea, all of you be subject one to another. And as we were talking about this morning, the leader is not a tyrant, he's not a dictator, in fact, he's a servant. And in many ways, he has to adapt himself to his family. And any time a husband is being considerate of his wife, in a sense, he's adapting to her. But because the husband is the breadwinner and he has the calling from God that God has given him, there just are times when he has to do something. And then for the wife to shape her plans as best she can around his schedule. But you know, adaptation is not something that just happens in a marriage. We have to do it on jobs. See, I'm an assistant to George Sanchez. And I don't go into him and give him my schedule and say, okay, George, this is what I'm going to be doing the next 3 months and make him adapt his schedule around mine. I feel since he's the head of the department, it doesn't mean he's more important than me or, you know, that it just means that the role God has given me is one of an assistant. So I go to him and I say, George, how are you going to spend your time the next 3 months? And he says, well, I've been thinking about this and this, and this is the schedule I've come up with. So I try my very best to work my schedule around his. But maybe a little conflict comes in there, something that he doesn't know. And so I can go to him and say, George, now you've planned for us to get together on Monday mornings here, and I've got this conflict. What do you think? And he, he says, we could move that very easily to Tuesday. So in a sense, then he'll come back and adapt to me. If possible, maybe he can't. So then we have to adapt to him. But I just feel that adaptation is something that everybody does. But a wife in the marriage relationship is called upon to take the first step to adaptation, and then the husband can come back and reciprocate. Now a need, and we'll just take a couple of minutes on this. Boy, there's many a wife this morning that is very frustrated in a marriage relationship. I've had him tell me in counseling, if my husband would only lead. A wife needs leadership in the relationship. And let me hasten on to say that this has nothing to do with personality. It has nothing to do with temperament. Sometimes you'll find a wife who is very aggressive and she's very expressive and extrovert and the husband is quiet. That in itself does not mean he cannot be the leader. Leadership has nothing to do with personality. In the marriage relationship, you're the leader because God has made you the leader. And the wife can be herself, and yet as long as she has that adaptation attitude. And leadership is something that a husband cannot demand. It must be given to him by his wife. But I do not believe that any woman who has the Holy Spirit wants to usurp the leadership in the family. Many have been forced to simply because the husband wouldn't lead. You say, well, how does that take place? Well, when the wife comes and says, honey, Billy is so disrespectful of me. Are you just going to sit there and let him talk to me that way? And the husband says, well, you just take care of that. You take care of the kids in the family. I'll go make the money, but you take care of the kids. See, he's abdicating leadership in that home. As a husband and a father, I should never allow my son to talk to his mother that way. Now, I better be careful how I do it, as I told you on Sunday night. But I need to step in there and make sure that he honors his mother. If there are financial problems in the home, if there's schedule problems in the home, if there's behavior problems in the home, if there's sickness in the home, I need to get in there as the high priest, as the counselor, as the one to help solve those problems. And leadership. It is not dictatorship. It is not having all the answers. Let me just give you one illustration. One day, I was sitting with a young couple who had been married about 5 years, and right off the bat, they said, Jim, we want to be very honest with you. The husband said, my problem is that I'm supposed to be the leader in this home, but out of every 10 good ideas that we put into practice in our marriage, 9 of them come from my wife. And he says, I'm just threatened, just to be very honest, her ideas are better than mine, and I'm supposed to be the leader. And the reason they came to me was because he was throwing all her ideas out the window and using his own inferior ideas because he was supposed to be the leader. And she was objective enough to know that he was, and she just thought, well, that's not the way it's supposed to be, throw good ideas out simply so he can be the leader, and they were frustrated. Well, I'd never run into that before in counseling, and I real quickly shot up a word of prayer saying, God, how in the world do I answer this one? It was so evident that she was, man, you could just see ideas popping out of her mind. And he was kind of sitting there, you know, like this. And I thought, what do I say? Is he the leader? And I shot up a word of prayer saying, God, how do I answer this? And God dropped this in my mind. I said to him, well, now, let's talk just a minute here. What is a leader? Is the leader the one who has all the good ideas? And I knew that couldn't be true. It's like Andrew Carnegie one time says, I don't have to have all the answers, but I better have somebody around me who does. And a leader is the one, we decided, who recognizes a good idea when he sees it. And secondly, he's the one who makes the decision. We will use that idea. And so I said to him, why don't you thank God that he gave you a wife with such a pregnant mind? And it was true. Boy, she just, her idea, her mind was just pregnant with ideas. She was a thinker. And I said, let her be a resource to the relationship. Man, take those ideas. Because I says, 1 out of every 10, like you said, is not going to be a good one. And you better know the difference. She doesn't have all the good ones. But because God has anointed you as the husband, you will be able, by asking by wisdom and prayer, to spot good ideas when you see them. And when she comes with them, take them, evaluate them, and then make the decision we're going to use the idea. Then I turned to her and I said, but if you, because you have all these good ideas, if you usurp the authority and you begin to get a superiority attitude and you devastate your husband, I said to her, you know, God will call you on the carpet like he did Aaron and Miriam. I said, your husband is not the leader because of his personality. He's the leader because God made him the leader. And I said, when you give those 9 ideas or 10, do it humbly. And so leadership is not dictatorship. It's not having all the answers. It's not always being right. But it's the willingness to solve problems, to get involved in solving problems, to make decisions after counsel, and to take interest in the interests of your family. Now, there's some decisions that we decided that Jerry will make those decisions. But I'm the one in consultation with her that I made the decision she will make those decisions. So, sometimes we husbands get scared out of it. But you know, let me just give you in closing a fantastic verse of Scripture, not only for husbands in leadership, but for husbands and wives as mothers and fathers. Proverbs 14:26 says, in the fear of the Lord is strong confidence, and his children shall have a place of refuge. There's a chain reaction there. My devotional life with Jesus Christ, my trust and reverence of him, eventually will more and more give me a strong confidence in my life. Not a pride, not a tyranny, but just a sense of God is with me. And then it's that confidence that causes my family to nestle under that leadership that I can provide. When it comes to the kids, it's what the confidence that Jerry and I have in the two of us being close to God and to each other. So, husband's leadership starts with the fear of the Lord. It's the beginning of wisdom. And don't worry about your personality. That's the personality God gave you. You have the leadership because he's put his hand on your head. But you've got to assume it. You cannot abdicate. And I believe that whatever takes place under the roof of my home in the lives of my wife and children, God is going to hold me responsible. And if my wife all of a sudden begins to drift, her devotional life cools off, and she begins to get further and further from the Lord, God's going to say to me someday, what did you do to get in there and help? Did you go and sit down with her and say, honey, can I be of help? How are things between you and the Lord? And love her back to that relationship. I am the high priest in the home, the counselor, and the prophet. Not because of gifts, but simply because God has said, husbands, love your wives and lead them. So, well, let's have a word of prayer.